The next case before us is United States versus Ojimba, and it's 20-6109. Mr. Autry, we are ready when you are ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Ojimba's Sixth Amendment right to a complete defense and to present all relevant evidence in aid of his defense was violated when the district court declined to allow him to question witnesses about and to introduce evidence on the fact that at the previous trial of this case, Mr. Ojimba was found not guilty of both substantive wire fraud counts relating to victim Pamela Bale and was also found not guilty of aggravated identity theft with respect to Hill Feinberg. Now, the government
in several cases said that that type of evidence is hearsay?
Your Honor, I believe you're referring to the Brown case. That was cited by the government at some length. That's an unpublished case. Also, the Sutton case. The Sutton case actually says that usually, not always, but usually, evidence of an acquittal is inadmissible evidence and is not relevant. We would suggest this is one of the rare circumstances where it is relevant.
And, well, how is this rare? It seems like if we allowed it in here, it would basically eat up the rule.
Your Honor, I disagree with that because in this case, the government, as I indicated a little bit before, wanted to and actually had it both ways. Even after the acquittals, they present Ms. Bale. Mr. Feinberg didn't testify at the retrial, but there was evidence related to his aggravated identity theft that was introduced by the government in aid of showing that Mr. Ojimba was guilty of the wire fraud conspiracy. Now, if they're allowed to introduce, over our objection and our motion to exclude it, the testimony of Ms. Bale, even though all substantive matters were resolved against convicting Mr. Ojimba as to anything relating to her, and the Hill Feinberg evidence, if that is admissible and they're allowed to get it in, then it is entirely misleading to the jury to not allow us to tell the jury that with respect to these two victims as to every substantive count, Mr. Ojimba was found not guilty.
Does it matter here that the charges are different? The specific charges in the first trial where there is an acquittal, that those charges are very different from the conspiracy charge?
No, Your Honor, they are different, but they are all related. And the government introduced evidence regarding the substantive offenses supposedly committed against Ms. Bale and Mr. Feinberg in aid of their case that Mr. Ojimba was somehow guilty of this wire fraud conspiracy. So it all relates together, and we would submit that this acquittal evidence, it does not have to be definitive. It does not have to result automatically in an acquittal of the wire fraud conspiracy count. However, it is entirely relevant.
Counsel, take a breath.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Because I hear your argument as to the evidentiary question, and in light of our theory, and I'm sure you've thought about this, how would you write a rule that makes the exception that you're arguing for evidentiary, the admission of the acquittal? I've looked at that.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I would argue that where the government uses acquitted evidence in its case in chief to try to prove another count, and the defendant was acquitted of that activity previously, he or she ought to be able to tell the jury that. Now, if they decided to forego altogether Ms. Bale's testimony and anything relating to Mr. Feinberg, that's one thing.
Well, but what makes it under an exception that it's still not hearsay?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's any more hearsay than a guilty verdict, which is excluded from the hearsay rule under 803.22.
Well, the reason the guilty verdict goes in is because we really know what that says. We don't know why the jury acquits someone.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because the jury's charge is to convict somebody if and only if the government proves beyond a reasonable doubt, each element of the offense charge. So it's readily.
So again, the elements in the first trial are different from the elements in this trial. Is that not true?
That's correct. The elements of the charges are different, but the evidence is being used by the government to prove the conspiracy charge. And the jury should be informed that that evidence should not be taken into much account, if at all, because the defendant has previously been acquitted of it. So it's relevant evidence. It's not dispositive. It certainly doesn't prove innocence or anything of that nature, but it would tend to show that it's more probable than not that if Mr. Ojemba is acquitted on all of these substantive charges, it is more likely than not that he's not guilty of the conspiracy. That's all we're arguing.
But that you're presuming that you can't be guilty of conspiracy unless you are guilty of a crime that was committed by the co-conspirators.
No, Your Honor, that's not our argument. We're not saying that
the acquittal had to do with an individual crime. That was one of the things that the co-conspirators did within their conspiracy, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so for conspiracy, you don't need to prove all the elements of the crime, of the underlying crime, as opposed to being a active member of the conspiracy itself.
I agree with that. The elements are different. The offense is different. But as I indicated before, it's all interrelated, and they are using evidence of the substantive crimes for which Mr. Ojemba was acquitted to support their conspiracy charge. Shouldn't the jury in that instance be given all of the relevant information that bears on that evidence as to whether it's persuasive or not that Mr. Ojemba, in fact, committed the wire fraud conspiracy? That's all we're arguing, is that it's relevant evidence and not irrelevant evidence. And I know in the Brown case, the court stated that with respect to the residual hearsay exception, that does not apply to permit evidence of an acquittal because it is not probative. It doesn't prove innocence. We suggest that that is misplaced, that emphasis is misplaced. The question is the evidence relevant? Does it tend to make more probable than not that because he was acquitted of all these substantive charges, Mr. Ojemba was not involved in the conspiracy, and that the government cannot prove that he was a member of the conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt?
Counsel, do you agree with the authority that we already have there that this is hearsay?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor, because I think, as we indicated in our brief, although without a heck of a lot of elaboration, that a not guilty verdict can certainly be considered a record of a regularly conducted activity under 8036, a public record. It's clearly a public record. Verdict is a public record under 803.8 and the residual exception, because it is clearly relevant, and the acquittal evidence is the most probative evidence possible, because he didn't do these things.
So you know that one panel in our court cannot overrule an earlier case unless it's been in bank. So you're saying that we're wrong in the 10th Circuit by saying that that's hearsay?
Well, I think that an argument can be made.
I don't care about what an argument can be made. Do you know what the rule is in regards to our court? Because you're saying we erred in saying that it's hearsay. Now, this panel cannot overrule another panel unless it's done by in bank. Do you agree with that rule?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with it.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
I would also point out that the Sutton case, as I indicated earlier, did not close the door altogether, and that's a published opinion, did not close the door altogether on acquitted evidence. It just said, usually it's not admissible. But in this case, where the government wants it both ways and got to get it both ways, it should be admissible to correct the record. Now, the government also argues that the doctrine of curative admissibility would not permit evidence of the acquittals because the evidence relating to Ms. Bail and Mr. Feinberg as presented at the second trial, at the second trial was properly admitted.
And well, that's true, right? If we rule against you on whether the testimony was admissible on the hearsay issue, then you also lose on the curative admissibility issue. They're linked, right?
I think they are linked, Your Honor. However, I think the curative admissibility doctrine, I think, can be read a little bit more broadly than the government is reading it. The curative admissibility doctrine, the way I understand it, can also be used to correct misleading impressions or misleading inferences the government wants the jury to draw from evidence that is not completely explained to the jury because we can't tell them the whole story. And here's the other point.
Well, I thought really the thrust of that doctrine was a sort of two wrongs don't make a right. In other words, if something was erroneously admitted against the defendant then can come back and say, I will clear the record up with this counter evidence. And that's what I thought curative admissibility went to.
That's true in the usual instance, Your Honor. I certainly don't disagree with any of that, but let's look at it this way. They're arguing and argued successfully that the testimony at the retrial of Ms. Bail and the testimony related to Mr. Feinberg were properly admissible, that it's all relevant. Yet, on the other hand, they want to argue that the acquittals are irrelevant because we're dealing with a different charge. If the acquittals are irrelevant, then isn't the evidence itself irrelevant? How does the evidence itself advance the ball?
Well, you're mixing, it seems to me, claim preclusion with issue preclusion. This is not the Wittig case. The Wittig case is a case where we said, let's look at this evidence and see if this defendant can stand trial again. And that is not what we have here. We have, again, as I think you've even agreed a couple of times, we have different charges in two different trials.
Correct.
Right. So we're looking at what evidence can be submitted properly in the second trial.
That's
we're
right.
Not asking the question, can he stand trial on this charge?
Correct. I don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah.
My point is, if it's irrelevant as to the conspiracy charge, the acquittals,
right,
how's the evidence itself relevant to the conspiracy charge? Because it deals with substantive matters. The Bail testimony and the Feinberg testimony both dealt with substantive matters.
Well, the court said that the evidence is admitted for the proper purpose to describe object, manner, and means of the conspiracy.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, and that evidence would be relevant on those points, right?
Your Honor, arguably it is. If it is relevant on those points, then I think that strengthens our argument as to the first proposition of error we raised. If it's relevant on those points, it's also relevant to give the jury the complete picture as to how a previous jury dealt with this evidence. Granted, they're not precluded from charging him again or going to trial again on the conspiracy count that the jury deadlocked on in the first case, but it's more than passing strange to me that they should be able to have it both ways, and that's what they had in this case, and it handcuffed Mr. Ojemba's defense. It misled the jury, and because of that, Your Honor, we believe that we are entitled to a new trial on count one, the wire fraud conspiracy count, and we would ask the court to reverse it. I see my time is about 2 minutes left, and if there are no further questions from the panel right now, if I could, I would like to reserve 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Coffey?
Well, good morning, Judge McHugh, and may it Please the court. My name is Nick Coffey for the United States. This court should affirm the judgment sentence of the trial court because each of the evidentiary rulings it made as regards to Pamela Bale's testimony, the acquittal conduct, and the WhatsApp chats were well within the trial court's discretion, and they were consistent with this court's precedent. And additionally, the sentence that was ultimately imposed, which was 102 months, 66 months below the bottom of defendant's guideline range of 168 months, was procedurally and substantively reasonable. Turning first to the issue about whether the acquittals were properly excluded, consistent with this court's precedent and the precedent of other districts, I mean, it is hearsay, as you pointed out, Judge McHugh. There is no hearsay exception, which allows for judgment of acquittals to be admitted.
Isn't there something just fundamentally unfair about taking somebody to trial on a criminal matter and they are not found guilty, they get an acquittal on the charges, and then you take them back on a conspiracy charge that really just wraps up the substantive charges they just got the acquittal on, and you present the same evidence, and the jury never gets to hear that for some reason a prior jury found the evidence was insufficient to convict on those underlying substantive crimes?
Well, Judge McHugh, I don't think that it's unfair. I think what Mr. Ojimba's arguing is that somehow the jury was led to believe that he was directly involved in the Pamela Bale wire fraud transfers. But if you look at the record, those were points that were raised on cross-exam. The very first line of questioning of Ms. Bale by Mr. Autry was, well, do you have any evidence that Mr. Ojimba was involved in your wire fraud transfers? And have you ever met him? And Ms. Bale said no. Similarly, Mr. Autry asked Agent Schmitz, well, do you have any evidence that Mr. Ojimba was involved in the Pamela Bale wire fraud transfers? And he said, no, we're just drawing the connection based off that Hill Feinberg photograph that Ms. Bale had identified. So as far as misleading the jury, the evidence was there, and the jury heard that Mr. Ojimba didn't have any direct link to Ms. Bale in regards to these two wire fraud transfers. But turning back from the fairness question to the hearsay question, there is no authority for admitting this under 803.22. And though Mr. Ojimba is claiming that there is authority for admitting it under 803.8, the public records exception, this court actually said the exact opposite in the Brown case when it reasoned that that would essentially be backdoor a judgment of acquittal when 803.22 makes no exception for a judgment of acquittal. And as far as the residual hearsay exception, it fails here for the same reason that it failed in Brown. This court pointed out in
Brown's unpublished, right? So we're not bound by Brown, are we?
You're not bound by Brown, Your Honor, but I'd argue that it's at least persuasive because the facts are pretty close with what they are here, at least as regards to an acquittal on a previous substantive count that is related to the conspiracy charge. But I'd also argue, though, looking at the residual hearsay exception, the second prong of that is whether it's material to the question before the jury. And here, it's not even material because the jury was tasked with deciding whether Mr. Ojimba joined this conspiracy. It was not tasked with deciding whether Mr. Ojimba was directly involved in the wire fraud transfers. And that's also why it was proper for the court to allow Ms. Bell to testify about.
Help me recall in this conspiracy charge, was there an overt act listed?
There were several overt acts listed, Judge Briscoe. And I think what's important here is that the overt acts listed did not just list the Pamela Bell wire fraud transfers. The overt acts and the means and objects of the conspiracy listed, used the word victims, which is why the trial that took place, the conspiracy charge was so much broader than the Pamela Bell wire fraud transfer, which is why defendant, and it's his burden, cannot.
Was the Pamela Bell wire fraud an overt act listed in the indictment?
It was not an overt act listed in the indictment, Your Honor. Pamela Bell, or PB, was simply listed in the wire fraud counts, count 3 and 4. So, Your Honors, because this was such a broader count, the Pamela Bell wire fraud transfers took place in May of 2014. The charge conspiracy was from May of 2014 to January of 2016. So it's much broader in time. And it also featured other victims apart from Mrs. Bell, including Nancy Meager, Carol Hill, and Beryl Wycliffe. So that is why the Mr. Ojimba here cannot satisfy the Ash test. Simply put, because the second prong of that test asks whether is the issue that was decided at the first trial necessary to the prosecution's case in the second proceeding? And here, as you pointed out, Judge Briscoe, it wasn't necessary, because the government wasn't required to prove that Mr. Ojimba caused Ms. Bell to send those wire transfers in order to convict him on the overarching conspiracy charge. As far as the other two issues, the WhatsApp evidence, there wasn't an objection at trial to the authentication and foundation of that evidence. Mr. Ojimba claims that it was somehow unreliable, but the government submits that those were the very types of things that were elicited on cross-exam and were also elicited through the testimony of their witness, Brenda McKay, who testified on some of the vulnerabilities of the WhatsApp server. And then as far as the last issue, turning to that, the vulnerable victim enhancement, there were numerous, a well-explained reasoning by the sentencing court in this case, specifically noting that the scheme targeted older, divorced, or widowed women with significant financial means.
If you have significant financial means, that makes you vulnerable?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. It made these women vulnerable in this context because they had significant financial means, but not the financial wherewithal to invest those into spot, sham investments. I think where the significant financial means portion matters is it's one of the reasons that the victims were targeted in the first place. Mr. Ojimba claims that these women somehow were not vulnerable, but you don't even have to take these victims' words for it. You can take Mr. Ojimba and Mr. Azia's WhatsApp chat for it, where they discuss targeting the right kinds of women, making sure that these women aren't divorcees and that they weren't widowed too long ago. I'd also point out that in the PSR, which the sentencing court adopted, there is testimony that Mr. Azia gave at Ms. Ejiofor's trial, where he specifically notes that he's looking for women that were less educated because it would be quote unquote easier to sell the con.
Let me ask you about United States versus Cabrera from our court, where we say that not only do you have to have particularized evidence of the victim's vulnerability, but the evidence must also distinguish the victim as atypical of the usual targets of the relevant criminal conduct. From what you've just told me, these victims were typical of the victims of this criminal conduct, not atypical.
Well, Judge McHugh, I think what you have to look at is this victim or these victims here typical of all types of fraud schemes? Because the victims of fraud schemes come in all shapes and sizes, of course. But this was a very select set. These were women that had been widowed, that were new to online dating, and that didn't have financial training or wherewithal and familiarity with investments. You know, in a way, Judge McHugh, I think that almost would defeat the purpose of the vulnerable victim enhancement, because if you have, for example, a defendant who is deciding to target a very select group of people, suppose, for example, that a defendant is marketing a type of, fake miracle drug, and he's targeting it only to cancer patients. Well, the reason he's targeting them is because he knows they're vulnerable and he knows that they're more likely to buy the product and they're desperate. It would seem a bit self-defeating for the defendant then to be able to turn around and say, well, you know what? I only targeted cancer victims, and therefore they're not atypical of the normal scheme. They're all the same. So I think looking at it here, what you have to do is take these women and put them against the backdrop of all types of fraud victims and see if they're atypical in this case. What's important here, Judge McHugh, is that Kenazia and Mr. Ojimba certainly thought that these women were atypical, which is why that they were targeting them.
Thank you.
And Your Honors, if seeing no further questions, we'd simply ask that you affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Autry, it looks like you have almost 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the vulnerable victim enhancement, the example of the cancer patient is obviously not pertinent to this case. Certainly, a cancer patient is vulnerable because of their disease and would be especially vulnerable to some kind of phony cure. Here, the vulnerability allegedly stems from only two or three things. Number one, these women were older. Number two, they were recently widowed. Number three, they were recently divorced. And number four, they had money. That does not make them unusually vulnerable outside the universe of, as Judge McHugh stated, the typical victim of this type of fraud scheme. And if we're going to say that older women who have money and are widowed and divorced are for those reasons vulnerable, then we have millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of potentially vulnerable victims in this country. I don't think that that is the case. They have not shown any unusual vulnerability among these victims. And to the extent that the court finding that they were especially vulnerable drove the sentencing decision in any way, at a minimum, the case should be remanded for resentencing.
Well, how would it affect the sentence? This was an increase on that point of what, two levels?
Yes, Your Honor. It would affect the advisory guideline range that in turn could affect the degree of the downward variance. So we think it's relevant.
So it's the old argument of we have to make absolutely certain where the court starts on the sentencing range. And if you can say the starting point is questionable, then you have a good argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. We will take this matter under advisement.